session number 10666 rule 2.
Group Captain Smith, rule 2. So, during this period of 41-42, were there any technical changes in types of aircraft which tilted the balance either way towards the British or the Germans?
Yes. We, halfway through 1941, I can't remember exactly when, but somewhere around about June or July, we got the first cannon aircraft. The Mark V Spitfire was armed with two 20mm cannon and four 303 machine guns. And this made a big difference to our operations because the cannon, of course, had a much firmer striking power. And when you hit something with it, you know, the aeroplane that you hit was severely damaged, no matter where you hit it with a 20mm, especially with a high explosive. And also we had armor-piercing 20mm, which helped because it went through the German armor-plated plate, which protected the pilot. I think, really and truly, the important thing to remember about this particular period of operations over France was the numbers that we did. And it might be interesting for me to tell you that in the period from this January 1941 to the end of 1941, I completed over 175 operational flights over France. And in the following year, I did another 150. Up till the middle of summer before going to North Weald. And by the time I went on my first rest, which was in December 1942, by which time I'd been a pilot, a flight commander, and a squadron commander, and then promoted to wing leader at North Weald in September 1942. And in that whole period, I flew over 350 operational sorties, including ones over the UK as well. So that it was the intensity of operations rather than the, you know, the actual operation itself. Because even if you didn't see any enemy over France, you were tensed up from the moment you crossed the English Channel until you got back again. And you could never go to sleep. You had to have eyes in the back of your head. And, of course, you had a job to do, and that job was to protect the bombers. And if you were top escort, well, then you protected the fighters below you. And so you could never relax. And at one stage, we were doing anything up to four of these operations a day.
So what kind of effect did these strains have on you?
Well, it depended on the resilience of the pilot. But most people sort of came to the conclusion that, you know, it was a question of how long was it going to be before, you know, you were going to catch it. Because, I mean, not even in the Battle of Britain did one fly that extensive in the way of operations, because we were fighting over our own territory then. And the operations were much shorter, and admittedly you came down, you landed and got refueled and went up again. But it was a different thing because you were over your own country. But there it was tension from the time you crossed the channel till you got back again, because you were over in a hostile sky.
Did any of your colleagues crack up?
I'm glad to say not many. I can only remember two who had to be sent off in the middle of their tour because they couldn't take it any longer. But, of course, it did tell in the Standard. And a lot of pilots, their standard went down because they were in many ways more obsessed with staying alive than being terribly brave, and myself included.
What kind of signs would a squadron leader have to look out for if somebody was under too much strain?
Well, there were several signs, and of course by the time you were commanding a squadron, I had 64 squadron at Hornchurch. In fact, I had the first squadron of Mark 9s while in command of it, and which was a splendid aeroplane. There were telltales, like, you know, the chap going back because his engine wasn't behaving properly, or he lost his number one, or he got separated, or, you know, silly sort of excuses like that. And one as a CO of the squadron, you were able to sort of string them together. And if you saw the signs, the kindest thing was to get him off on a rest. Unless it was straightforward sort of lack of guts, in which case you dealt with it in a different way.
How was that dealt with?
Well, we usually saw the station commander or someone like that, and the medical officer, and got him away probably for medical reasons, or unsuitability of the type of aircraft that he was flying.
But if it was just a question of that their resilience had gone, how would you approach them?
I'd have a chat with the pilot and say, do you think the time's come when you ought to go on a rest? We had a thing known as lack of moral fibre, which was a most unfortunate thing to deal with, because it meant that, it was the next worst thing to being a coward. But you had to take this into account, and one had to sort of realize that the type of chap that came under this category was really the type of man who was unsuitable to be a fighter pilot, that he was probably more suited to some other aspect of flying. Rather than sort of say, well, of course, he's just a coward, because it's like a game of cricket. There's some people who can bowl and some people who can bat, and some who are better at fielding than they are at anything else. And the great thing is to try and find the pilots who are suited to a particular type of aircraft and the type of operation that had to be done.
So, if somebody was pulled out because of lack of resilience, presumably you had to approach it tactfully so they didn't feel dishonored in any way.
Exactly, and also that one had to write a report about it and he had to sign it. So one had to be rather careful as to how you went about it. But I must go back to the beginning and say that I can only remember two who just didn't come up to it. I recognized two or three others who shouldn't have been fighter pilots, and we dealt with those in a straightforward manner. But just sheer lack of guts was not really very prevalent in the Royal Air Force, certainly in fighter command.
This in a way seems surprising, that there were so few examples of people lacking this kind of moral fibre when conditions were so tough in the Second World War for the RAF. How can you account for the fact that there were so few cases?
I think this may be sort of unacceptable to a lot of people, but I believe that my generation, those of us who left school in the 1930s and saw the war coming, and did something about it, like those who went into the Territorial Army, those who went into the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve, and those who went into the Royal Navy Reserve. We wanted to do it, and I think at that period in the war, which was the toughest period, of course, because we didn't have too many pilots and we didn't have too many aircraft, and we had some very sticky operations. But at that period, I think the bulk of England's youth, certainly that came to the Royal Air Force, and I can only speak from experience with my own service, that they were an extraordinary bunch of chaps, really, because they laughed at life. Difficult to pin it down, but I think that the fact of the matter is that we were the sons of our fathers, and our fathers had been through, I suppose there's no reason why I shouldn't say it, the bloodiest war in our history. And somehow, their attitude to life and their dedication to doing your stuff for your country rubbed off.
During this period, you were at Orhon Church, about in the middle of it. Of course, the Germans invaded Russia. Were you aware of any kind of effect that it had on your own experience when that happened? I mean, was there a sudden lessening of German air presence over France and the Low Countries?
Yes, there was a definite change. It happened about a couple of months, I suppose, before Germany invaded Russia, which was in June 41. And I would say that around about April, May 41, the standard of competence among the Messerschmitt pilots over northern France deteriorated. And we noticed this. The leaders were still good, and the formations were led extremely well. But once the formation got split up, and we sorted out a target apiece and got on the tail of a 109, they started behaving rather like a sheep on a Scottish mountainside. By that I mean that they weren't quite sure which direction they ought to go and what they really ought to do. And the wise ones rolled on their backs and pulled a stick back and got the hell out of it as quickly as they could. And I think that was more noticeable then than at any time before, from my experience anyway.
You said that you transferred from 611 Squadron to 64 Squadron.
No, I was a pilot in 611, then I became a flight commander in 603. And then from 603, I went into hospital with double pneumonia, brought on by high altitude flying and too much beer and too many cigarettes. And after I came out of hospital, I was an assistant adjutant, no, adjutant of Royal Air Force South End, Rochford. And then suddenly, in March 1942, I went into hospital at the end of November, and in March 42, Harry Broadhurst rang me up and said that I'd got command of 64 Squadron at Hornchurch. I remained with 64 Squadron until September, when I went to North Weald as Wing Commander Flying. And then in December I went to Fighter Command as Wing Commander Tactics at Fighter Command. And from there I went to Malta in April, end of April 1943. And was appointed Wing Commander Flying of the Lucca Wing in Malta. And from there I went to the Desert Air Force as Wing Commander Flying of 244 Wing, which was during the invasion of Sicily. Do you want me to continue?
Yes, please.
And since we're on it, we may as well go right the way through. from Wing Commander Flying at 244 Wing, after the invasion of Italy, in November 1943, I was appointed Group Captain in command of 324 Wing Desert Air Force, who at that time were operating in support of the American Fifth Army. And I stayed with them until March 1945, when I gave... The war was nearly over by then, certainly in Italy. And I went to number one base area in Naples for a while before coming back to England and going to the Staff College.
You were saying earlier about Harry Broadhurst being a remarkable man to serve under. Why did you say that?
Well, because he was. He was the most exceptional pilot, exceptional leader, a bit ruthless in his handling of things, but then he had a job to do, and he did it brilliantly. He was an inspiration to the young pilots, and he always insisted on talking to us and passing on, you know, his knowledge on not only tactics, but on other things as well. And he always gave you the most tremendous confidence when you were flying with him.
When you moved to the Mediterranean area and North Africa, conditions of flying must have been quite different then. Can you tell me how the desert conditions affected actual flying?
Well, not a great deal, because we were, after all, properly equipped by that time. We had good aeroplanes. We had, by that time, the Mark 9 Spitfire had sort of taken over, and the Mark 8, both excellent aeroplanes. And they were equipped with air cleaners, so that there was no likelihood of sand or dust or anything else getting into the engine. And there were plenty of them, you know. We were never short of the aircraft. And on the other side, the Germans were being stretched and stretched and stretched. What were the war in Russia and the lack of experience, because a lot of their experienced pilots had been shot down by them. And I don't think their heart was in the job either. So we didn't see an awful lot of the Luftwaffe. And for that reason, my wing eventually was converted to the fighter bomber role. And most of the fighter wings in Desert Air Force by then, some of them which were strictly air superiority fighters, were converted to carry bombs. We didn't get rockets, but we had bombs.
We hear a great deal in North Africa about the British Army's deception tactics against enemy air power. To what extent was German deception tactics for camouflaging their tanks and having dummy tanks and dummy equipment, how much of that were you aware of in your operation?
Well, yes, we were always aware of it, and their camouflage, particularly when they were static, was excellent. But it had become latterly, certainly in 1943, in Italy, a war of attrition. It was close country, very difficult for movement, heavy rains when the winter came, bog conditions in the field, roads and all the rest of it. And so, from our point of view, we didn't see an awful lot of German movement, because they were very well camouflaged, and not only that, but they were greatly helped by the terrain, because mountainous country, a wooded country, and all the rest of it. So our targets were mostly frontline targets, within 5 to 8 miles from the front from our own front line, in support of army operations.
So often it was a question of great accuracy of bombing.
Yes, but you've got to also remember that we had developed in the latter stages in the desert, and certainly in Sicily, because of the close country and because of the terrain which I've just described, that we had to then be able to lead our fighters onto the fighter bomber targets much more accurately. And it was from this that the famous cab rank system developed, which was an Eighth Army system which had been developed first of all in the desert and improved upon in Sicily and improved upon again in Italy. And in that you had a qualified Army Air Force team in a Jeep or a 1500 weight who was able to, with the gridded maps, and the pilot in the air, the leader, had a similar map in his possession, was able to be guided onto the target by the soldier and airman on the ground who was in contact on a single channel, which was a closed channel to everybody else, where he could talk to the leader and describe the terrain and actually bring you right over the target, and you finally sort of turned around and said to him, "Okay, I've got the target, I'm going down." It was as accurate as that.
What kind of bombs were you using?
Well, on the Spitfire we used 500-pounders. One 500-pounder on under the belly.
Were there any problems in using the bombs?
No, provided the things had been tested properly, the functioning. I can't remember ever having a hang-up, but it didn't matter because you could jettison it if there was a hang-up. And we developed tactics which were extremely accurate. And later on, of course, it helped me enormously because after the war I went back to squadron leader in rank, and as such I got command of 60 Squadron in Malaya, and of course it was all fighter bombing there. And, my experience was well worthwhile.
If I can ask you some questions about the Malayan emergency, can you tell me whereabouts you were based in Malaya
yes,
yourself?
Yes, I was in Tengah, in Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, and Penang, Butterworth at Penang. Those are our three main bases.
Which squadron was it there?
60. One of the RAF's very old squadrons, First World War. Top scoring squadron in the First World War.
It must have been extraordinarily difficult to use air power against a guerrilla enemy.
Yes, it was. Apart from which, of course, it was worse than trying to drop bombs in the sea, because you could never really pinpoint your target. You could get fairly close, but the maps all were out of date, and we had to rely mostly on photographs. And eventually we were able to get a system going where we could talk to the forward troops on the ground. But that was a bit of a hang-up, because depending on the trees, the VHF didn't work very well. And the only other way we could do it was to put an Auster in the air with a chap on it on the same frequency as the chap leading the Spitfires. And he could sort of say, "Well, just I'll go and dive down and I'll show you where the target is." By which time, of course, the banditos, Malayan insurgents, rather Chinese insurgents underneath, having heard the aircraft and one thing and another, pushed off. But we did have some strikes, and which were worthwhile, and hit a few camps. But we never saw the results because the trees were too thick. We had to do the bombing through the trees and the rocketing.
But the army would go in and report you if you hit a camp.
And that was the way we found out, yeah. They even sent us back one of the communist flags, which had been left behind after we'd devastated one of the bandit camps. We'd hit it very well, actually. And so as a mark of their esteem, they sent us the hammer and sickle.
You don't recollect an operation in Malaya by the name of Operation Kingly Pile, do you?
Kingly Pile? No, I don't.
Did you ever have incoming fire from the guerrillas against your planes?
I don't know. Not that I'm aware of. I think they use small arms. I lost, one, two, three pilots under unforeseen circumstances. They didn't call or anything else and suddenly disappeared into the jungle. And two others who came back with engine trouble and finally crashed. But it was a very difficult one to say, yes, they did or they didn't. They certainly, I, in my own experience, never saw bursting flak, you know. If it had been, it might have been heavy machine guns or rifles, and that's about it.
So planes didn't come back full of holes?
I can't remember ever having any that came back with holes. No, our biggest enemy there was the jungle. And we were using very old Spitfires, which had been with the Indian Air Force. And, you know, the thing we had to worry about was some of the targets were 175 miles from base, you know. And by the time you'd got there and got back again, you were jolly pleased to see base again, because if you got an engine cut there, that was the end of it.
In Vietnam, the Americans had a lot of trouble with guerrilla attacks on their bases. Did you ever have that, or
no.
Sabotage at the bases?
No. We were too well protected by the army and the police.